So someone could ask if they could wait a day to hand in the problem set, and I said it was fine, so it's okay to turn them to submit the second problem set tomorrow. I think I also needed an extension on writing problem set 3, so that works for me. I was trying to finish it before the lecture, but I didn't quite get it done. So I should post it on the wiki later today. Well, are there any questions before I start talking about MCMCs again? Okay. So in Bayesian statistics, we often find ourselves in the situation of having a likelihood function in a large number of variables, where this would be the posterior likelihood of some model parameters given some data, which by Bayes' theorem is the same thing as the conditional probability of the data given the parameters, multiplied by some prior, and then normalized to have integral 1. And straightforward methods for exploring this likelihood, like evaluating it on a grid, tend to scale exponentially in the number of variables. But Monte Carlo methods tend to have a more favorable scaling. If the likelihood is well-behaved, like reasonably well approximated by a Gaussian, I'll talk about this in more detail later, then, for example, you can expect the computational cost of generating samples to go linearly, not exponentially, in the number of variables. So we're going to represent the likelihood. Formally, you can think of this as representing the likelihood by a sum of delta functions at the location of some samples. But I haven't talked yet about the actual MCMC algorithms that let you generate a sequence of random samples theta I, starting from a procedure to evaluate the likelihood function at a point in parameter space. So I'm going to start out by talking about the theory of Markov chains. And I realized last time that a lot of people have seen this before, but not everyone has. So I'm going to talk about it as if, build it up from scratch as if you're seeing it for the first time. So on a finite state space, it's easiest to define a Markov chain by example and then give a more formal definition. So if you consider this picture, then the circles in the picture are supposed to represent states. So this would be, I'll denote the state space by a capital X. So that would be a three-element set in this example. And the arrows are supposed to be interpreted as transition probabilities. And a Markov chain is just a sequence of states generated by randomly choosing transitions. So you generate each guy from the previous guy by choosing a transition with the appropriate probability. So in this chain, you would just go around the loop until you reach the one state, and then you might stay on that state for a few iterations and then proceed around the loop again. So the Markov chain, you know, in this example, might. So I think the Markov chain is a sort of a finite state machine with some probabilities. The way it's defined in the discrete math books is a little differently. So the way, when you see the definition, usually it's phrased slightly differently as saying that, first off, the probability of selecting the I plus first element in the sequence, given the previous history, just depends on the ith element in the sequence. This property that the chain doesn't remember the whole history, but just remembers the last element, is what's called the Markov property. And then the other thing that's supposed to be true is that this transition probability as a function of the two states which appear, let's call that. I'll usually write it this way, is independent of I. So the same set of transition probabilities are used uniformly throughout the chain. And this condition is sometimes called homogeneity. So when I say Markov chain, I mean a homogeneous Markov chain by default. But in the math books, it's usually the homogeneity condition is usually distinguished from the Markov property. Okay. Now here's something that's true in this simple example, and I think it's pretty intuitive, that if I let pk from x to x prime denote the probability of ending at x prime after k iterations, starting at state x, then so for example, in this problem, P1 is just denotes the matrix of transition probabilities. If I use a matrix notation and where the row index is the x and the column index is the x prime, then I guess it would look like this. Pk is just the kth power of this matrix in the matrix sense. And something that's true in the simple example is that I take the limit of that set of k-step transition probabilities, then first off, the limit exists, which is not a priori totally obvious. And is given by some set of values that I worked out. Depends on x prime, but not x. In other words, as I iterate that chain, I eventually wash out memory of the initial conditions and settle into some set of some equilibrium set of probabilities that doesn't depend on where I started. You could verify that by taking kth powers of this matrix, and you reach this limit pretty quickly. So this is a specific case of the fundamental, this equilibrating behavior is a special case of the fundamental theorem of Markov chains. It can be stated as follows, at least for a finite state space. So first, let's see, before I state that, I should write a definition. A chain is strongly mixing. There exists a k greater than zero, such that this k step probability is non-zero positive for all x in x prime. This chain is strongly mixing. You can convince yourself that if k is four or larger, then there's a non-zero probability of getting from any state to any other state in k steps. It would not be strongly mixing if, for example, I'm going to lower the board just enough to erase, but not enough to cover up the definition. If I remove this guy, then it would not be strongly mixing if the chain just sends you around in a loop. Because there has to be one value of k that works for all pairs of states x and x prime. So a periodic Markov chain is not strongly mixing. And then the fundamental theorem says that if a chain is strongly mixing, then this limit of the k-step probabilities that we talked about before exists and is independent of x. So the strong mixing condition is the property that ensures that there's some long-run equilibrium distribution of probabilities. As a statement, oh, I forgot the case subscript. Since this matrix of probabilities, you know, is just the kth power of the matrix P1, then the fundamental theorem can be equivalently restated as the statement that the original matrix P has to have one eigenvalue which is equal to 1, and all the other eigenvalues have absolute value less than 1. So that as I take the limit as k goes to 0, if I have a matrix like that with one unit eigenvalue and a bunch of eigenvalues that are less than 1, then when I take its kth power and take the limit as k goes to 0, I just get the projection operator onto the eigenspace associated with the unit eigenvalue. And so that's why what's coming out is just projection onto some universal set of probabilities. So I think the fundamental theorem is actually really non-obvious. I did write out a proof, but it took in the lecture notes that I'll try to put online soon. The proof takes a few pages. It's a little bit messy. So I decided to omit the proof for the... The proof is sort of messy and doesn't really give much insight, so I decided to omit the proof in the lectures. So this limiting value, call it P infinity of X prime, is called the limiting distribution of the chain. Or limiting probability distribution. If you want to solve for it, well, the limiting distribution should have the property that if I start with a set of probabilities that are sampled from the limiting distribution, you know, if I start out in that in distribution P infinity and then take one step, then I should stay in that distribution. Translated to an equation, if I start off in distribution P infinity and sum over always and getting to X prime, then I should still have probability P infinity of X prime. And this equation is called the detailed balance condition. To find the limiting distribution for this example chain, I solved the detailed balance equation. And it does indeed have a unique solution, as the fundamental theorem implies. In linear algebra language, this is just the equation that defines an eigenvector, a left eigenvector, since this matrix of probabilities is not necessarily symmetric. The distribution P infinity, if I interpret this as a matrix and this guy as a vector, then the detailed balance condition is the condition that P infinity is a left eigenvalue, left eigenvector of the transition probability matrix with eigenvalue 1. Okay. So the idea of MCMC, so far it's not obvious how any of this ties back to the machinery, ties back to the original problem of generating a sequence of samples from some Bayesian likelihood function. So far I've sort of presented the theory of Markov chains, and I think it's sort of the clearest way to present it, to imagine that this matrix of probabilities is like externally given to you, and then this limiting distribution is something that you would calculate either by, I suppose you could simulate it by iterating forward, or you could solve this detailed balance equation. The idea of MCMC is to sort of reverse the logic. So the idea is to given some limiting distribution P, let's call that a target distribution. Construct a set of transition probabilities. Such that the limiting distribution P infinity corresponding to the set of transition probabilities is the desired target distribution. And you should imagine an example where the number of states is huge, some exponentially sized set or even a continuously parameterized space of states, where you couldn't just enumerate every state and compute the probability. Like in this example, if you want, if I wanted to sample from a probability distribution on three states, well, that's trivial to do. You just compute all three probabilities, and it's trivial to generate a random variable with that set of probabilities. But in a case where there's some enormous number of states where you can't really evaluate P at every point in the state space, then and you have no algorithm for sampling from P, then the idea of MCMC is to build up some set of transition probabilities where you do know how to draw random samples, which is cleverly constructed in such a way that it gives the target distribution P in the limit of many iterations. And then you sort of iterate that chain to build up complex randomness, samples from a probability distribution that you don't know how to sample a priori, from simple randomness, some set of transition probabilities that you can sample from. And MCMC is sort of a bag of tricks for writing down transition probabilities that satisfy this property. For a given target distribution, the transition probabilities reproduce it in the limit where you iterate the chain. There's more than one algorithm. We're doing this, but I'm going to talk about the simplest algorithm and also very practically useful, the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm. So the rough idea, like a cartoon of the way the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm would work, is that I have some state space. And let's imagine it's a continuous space, and like this space of cosmological parameters for a CNB experiment. And I have some target distribution P of X that I don't know how to sample from globally, but I know I can evaluate one point at a time. For example, the likelihood function for a set of CNB multiples. What I do is I build a random walk. So there'll be some proposal density. I build a random walk where I start at a point in the space, and then I propose a new point, and another point after that, and so on, from some so-called proposal density. Which I'll leave arbitrary at this point, and I'll talk about how you make a good choice of proposal density later. The only condition that the proposal density absolutely has to satisfy is that you do need to have an algorithm for given an X sampling an X prime from the proposal density. You couldn't take the proposal density to be equal to P, for example, because the whole idea is that you don't know an algorithm in advance for sampling from distribution P. But it could be, let's say, Gaussian in the difference x minus x prime, and then if you iteratively sample from the proposal density, you're just carrying out a Gaussian random walk on space. So if all you did was iterate this proposal density, then you would have a Gaussian random walk, say, that had nothing to do with the target distribution P that you're trying to satisfy or sample from. And the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm, the magic of it is that it gives you a way of biasing the random walk so that it prefers regions of high P. And it can be shown, in fact, that the samples that you get asymptotically are samples from probability distribution P. The idea basically is that you propose a new point, X, if the chain is currently at X, you propose a new point X prime, just using this proposal density with no reference to the point P. And then you just compare the likelihoods, you evaluate the likelihood function P at the old point and the new point. And depending on whether the new point is more likely than the old point or not, you either go to it or you might stay at the old point with some probability. So that's the cartoon. And uh, the formal definition works like this. I have some target distribution and some proposal density, which is arbitrary for now. Except that I'm assuming that I have an algorithm for randomly sampling an x prime given an x, and another condition that'll need to be satisfied is that it is given x, it is a probability distribution in x prime. Then I construct the chain. So it's easiest to write down in words the way the procedure works, and then figure out what set of transition probabilities p from x to x prime it's describing. So you construct a chain. It's one x two. As follows. So in a loop, if I'm at point xi and I'm trying to generate the I plus first point, the first thing I do is generate a proposal x prime. From the proposal probability distribution. Then I compute this ratio. Now, very often the proposal density is a symmetric density where the probability of going from proposing point x prime given point x is the same as the probability for going the other way. And in that case, the q's here would cancel, and r would just be the ratio of likelihoods. R is greater than 1 if the new point is more likely than the old point, likely in the sense of the target distribution p, and r is a number between 0 and 1 if the new point is less likely than the old point. And the last step, I guess I'm writing here. I want to accept the proposal with probability r and reject the proposal with probability 1 minus r. So formally, let u be a uniform random number between 0 and 1. And I take the point xi plus 1 to be the proposal x prime if u is less than r. So that means that the proposal was accepted. And the old point x if u is greater than r. So that means I don't take a random walk step to the new point x prime. I just stay at x, and then in the next iteration, I'll draw a new independent point x prime from the proposal density. In particular, the way that I phrase the rule here, if r is greater than 1, in other words, if the new point is more likely than the old point, then you would always accept, since u will always be less than r. But if the new point is less likely than the old point, then the probability of acceptance is just the likelihood. in particular. Should always accept if R is greater than. So this algorithm describes, you know, some sort of random walk, which is starting with a random walk described by the proposal density, and then modifying that random walk by accepting or rejecting based on whether the random walk is going in the direction of larger p. So this is some sort of biased random walk which prefers regions of larger p. It's not obvious from this description precisely what probability distribution it's sampling from asymptotically. And in particular, it's not, you know, it's not obvious that the limiting probability distribution has to be p. So that's the next thing that I'm going to show. I'm going to prove that this works. And the way that I'm going to show it is that I'm going to prove that the detailed balance condition is satisfied where P is the target distribution in the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm, and there's too many little p's, and this two-variable little p is the matrix of transition probabilities. Now, in order to prove this, the first thing we'll need is an expression for the matrix of transition probabilities. That's implicit. The transition probabilities are implicitly described by this procedure, but we didn't actually write down an expression for the transition probabilities. So I want to define, to write that down, first let me define the acceptance probability. This is the probability of accepting, if I'm at the point x and I generate proposal x prime, this is the probability of accepting the proposal. And it's just the quantity r that I wrote down before, but then I take the minimum with 1 because the acceptance probability can't be greater than 1. Then I claim that the transition probability from x to x prime is given as follows. So in one iteration of the algorithm, I can get from x to x prime if I, starting at x, if I propose x prime and then accept it. And then there's also a term which represents rejection that has a delta function in it. So I stay at the point x if I propose x double prime and then reject it. And there's one way of doing that for every point x double prime in the state space. Now I'm using notation here that suggests a discrete state space. But the same proof would apply to a continuous state space. I just replaced the sums by integrals and the Kronecker deltas by delta functions in a way that's familiar to any physicist. Okay. So this line is just sort of a translation of the algorithm into a formula for the transition probability. So once you have this formula, the proof is fairly mechanical. So if I want to start with this left-hand side. And then if I plug in the two terms here, then I'll write the first term straightforwardly. In the second term, I'll end up with a sum over x and x double prime, but I can do I can use the delta function to do the x sum and just replace x's with x primes to write the result this way. You have x prime in front. Okay. Then this next step, I'm just noticing, let's see, maybe I'll, to avoid splitting a line across blackboards. So in this, first line, I can notice that these factors sitting in front, the p and the q, are both non-negative numbers. So I can just bring them inside the min. If I split the second line up into two terms, then the first term is x prime. And the last term, there's a minus sign, and I can do the same thing. I can bring the p and the q inside to write the result like this. Notice that the first term and the third term cancel, right? The only difference is that x and x prime, which are just dummy variables of the summation, have been switched, and the ordering of the two arguments to the minimum has been switched. And then in the second line, because the proposal density q is a probability distribution, if I sum it over all values of x double prime, I have to get 1. So the sum is equal to 1, and I just get p of x prime at the end. Which is what I wanted. So that's the proof that the detailed balance condition is satisfied. And now, as long as this is a strongly mixing set of transition probabilities, which will be the case for any reasonable choice of proposal density. For example, when the you know, case where the model space is some set of continuous cosmological parameters. The proposal density might say that you, starting at a point X, you add some a Gaussian random number for each dimension of the space to get a new point X prime. And then there is a non-zero, if I iterate, if I start with a Gaussian proposal density, then for any 2 points in the space, for any 2 points in the space, I can go straight from one to the other with a very tiny probability. Or if I take a large value of k, then there'll be some path with reasonable probability that gets there. So for reasonable proposal densities, the strongly mixing condition is always satisfied. And the fundamental theorem guarantees that the fundamental theorem plus the detailed balance condition guarantee that starting in an arbitrary state, the limiting distribution of the chain will be P. Okay, so that's the algorithm. I really want to show like a picture of it in action, and I have some slides, but I'll probably have to wait till next time. For now, I just want to make a few comments to try to get some intuition for the algorithm. So one extremely important property of this algorithm is that is that it only depends on likelihood ratios. Of the form P of X double prime over P of X prime over P of X. In the Bayesian analysis context, that's a crucial property since you rarely know the normalization of the likelihood function in advance. The likelihood function that we're interested in the P of X the likelihood function that you're interested in would have some form like this from Bayes' theorem. And even if you know the normalization of the conditional probability distribution P of D given theta and the prior P of theta, then in general, you don't have any good way of estimating this integral. Like in the CMB case, this is some integral over the space of six cosmological parameters. Without exploring the likelihood function, say putting it on a grid or something, which is the problem that we're trying to solve in the first place. So it's okay if the likelihood if you don't know this denominator, and the likelihood function is just specified up to an overall constant. Another little comment here is that more often than not, the proposal density is symmetric. So if the proposal density satisfies this symmetry property, as it would for a simple Gaussian random walk. Then this is called the Metropolis algorithm. Historically, Metropolis proposed the algorithm under the assumption of symmetry, and then Hastings showed up in a follow-up paper to show how you could relax that assumption. So usually we just use a symmetric proposal density, but I went straight to the Metropolis-Hastings slightly increased generality since the proof is no more complicated. So far I haven't really talked about how you choose the proposal density. And in fact, this is one of the making a good choice of proposal density is one of the main
practical issues that an MCMC practitioner will have to confront. So the algorithm formally works for any proposal density, provided that the density is strongly mixing, which is a really weak condition. But different choices of proposal density Q can lead to very different convergence rates or different performance. So very often, the proposal density is Gaussian. With some covariance matrix C sub Q. Then the result is a biased random walk. We want to sort of tune this covariance matrix so that it explores efficiently and doesn't reject proposals too often. So to understand how to do that, let's think about some toy examples where the target distribution P is also Gaussian. An example like this is artificial, since there would be no reason to run MCMC in the first place. Just directly sampling the target distribution is no harder than sampling the proposal density. It gives sort of a real example might be to just slightly modify this so that it's fairly close to this Gaussian but has some complicated form that you might not be able to sample from directly. You know, the whole point of MCMC is to build up complex randomness, like samples from some PDF that you can write down and evaluate, but you don't know how to sample from simple randomness, like a multivariate Gaussian. For example one, let's consider a case where the target distribution is a Gaussian whose covariance is a multiple of the identity matrix, and so is the proposal density. Just to get some intuition for what happens in different limits. Choosing a proposal density that's much wider than the width of the true distribution is bad because the chain the rejection rate of samples will be very high. You know, if I imagine that this is a level contour of the true distribution, and I have some point x, and then my proposal density is say 10 times wider, then I have a low probability, if I generate a random point proposal, then it will probably have a very tiny probability under p, leading to a very low acceptance probability, and I'll stay at this point forever. And the problem is really bad if the number of dimensions is large. Like if this is 10 times wider, then the probability of getting a decent acceptance probability, you know, is roughly 10 to the minus n, where n is the number of dimensions. So that sounds like exponentially bad, exponent in the number of dimensions. Another thing that's true is, however, is that if I take the proposal density to be too narrow compared to the true density, then the chain is slow to equilibrate or slow to explore. So if I reverse this picture and say that this outer circle is a level contour of the true distribution, I'm trying to explore it with a very narrow posterior distribution or proposal density, then what will happen is that my acceptance rate now will be nearly 100%. One proposal is barely changing the likelihood function. So the likelihood ratio that controls the acceptance probability will be very close to one. So there's no problem with generating new proposals and accepting them. The problem is that it's a random walk, which takes forever to get from one side of the distribution to the other. And so the samples that it generates are highly correlated. So here the problem is sort of, the situation is a little bit better in that the problem is sort of polynomially bad instead of exponentially bad. If the proposal were 10 times narrower than the true distribution, then it would need like 100 samples to get from one side to the other, since the excursion of a random walk goes as the square root of the number of samples. But the optimal thing, of course, is to have sigma q comparable to sigma p. A point I wanted to make is that, if you're running a chain and the rejection rate is very high, then it's very obvious that there's a problem. You just see the chain stuck in the same point and not making any progress. But if you have a rejection rate that's near zero, then generally speaking, that's also a symptom of poor performance. And there's a rule of thumb that says that you should try to choose the rejection rate of a chain to be around 30%. As far as I know, there's no particular calculation that gives this number. It's just sort of a rule of thumb that the practitioners recommend. So in the case of the multivariate Gaussian, in this example, it turns out, at least when the number of dimensions is large, this example has been studied and the optimal rejection rate, the optimal acceptance rate, just to quantify things a little bit, is turns out to be 23%. I didn't try to reproduce this calculation. Another thing that's true is that you should choose the width of the proposal density. So what you should do is just tune sigma q so that the rejection, the acceptance rate is a number around 30%. 23% would be optimal, but 30% is close enough. If you do that, you'll find that sigma q is equal to sigma p times a value which is of order 1 over the square root of the number of dimensions. And that the correlation length of the chain or the number of samples that are needed to get from one side of the distribution to the other is roughly of order n. So at least in this toy problem where everything is Gaussian, the computational cost of MCMC, or the cost of generating an independent sample, is roughly linear in the number of dimensions, which is what we wanted. Gridding was exponential, and we wanted something better than that. So generally speaking, MCMC generates correlated samples. If you think about this Gaussian toy problem in a large number of dimensions, then the proposal density has the optimal proposal density has a step size of around 1 over root n compared to the width of the true distribution, which means that it takes n samples for the chain to decorrelate from its starting location. And if I compare adjacent samples in the chain, they'll be highly correlated. So a useful diagnostic plot that I sometimes like to make when I'm running MCMCs is to plot like the correlation function of the chain. Which would, for a one-dimensional likelihood, you would just take as a function of the lag L, or the offset between samples. This ratio of expectation values would be the correlation coefficient between two samples separated by lag L, where the expectation values are taken over indices I at a fixed value of L. And what you would see, if everything is working well, is a correlation function which looks roughly exponentially decaying with some correlation time, which is the number of samples needed to, number of iterations of the chain needed to decorrelate the current position of the chain from its initial conditions. It's the number of, earlier I had said that, you know, a good goal would be to get something like 10 to the 5 samples from your distribution for Bayesian analysis. And of course, it's the number of independent samples that matters. So if your chain has correlation length lambda, then the number of iterations that you should run the chain for is more like 10 to the 5 lambda. And in some problems, it can be, you know, very challenging to get a low correlation length. In this toy example, in the limits of both small sigma q and high sigma q, the correlation length is going to infinity.
Sorry, question?
Oh, yes?
In this correlation calculation, is X R directly R samples or some observable or statistic calculated at each sample? And then?
So I was actually thinking of a one-dimensional chain. But in a multidimensional parameter space, you might choose to make this plot for every basis parameter, that is, every coordinate in the coordinate system. Or you could use a derived parameter if there are derived parameters of interest.
So it should be one-dimensional, regardless of what we choose it to be, right? I guess my question is, does it make sense to calculate it for a vector?
That's a good point, actually. I don't see, now that you mention it, I don't see anything wrong with doing this, right? That makes a lot of sense. I have, in practical examples, made this plot separately for each parameter in basis function in the coordinate space. But I like your vectorized definition better, I think. By the way, you should also subtract off the mean before you do this. I forgot to say that. It's 12:30, so I better stop there. I almost, but not quite, finished the lecture. So next time I'm going to do a few more sort of like thought experiments like this to illustrate what happens in simple toy examples. And then I'll show some pictures of an actual MCMC run on the computer.